said Tiffany. There was a beat.
What?
Said Dakota again, and she turned a page. Tiffany snorted. She opened a new email. It was from St. Anastasia's, the super posh private school that Dakota would be attending next year. Tiffany wouldn't be able to follow her daughter into that new world either. Vid's three daughters from his first marriage, Dakota's three older stepsisters, had all attended St. Anastasia's, which wasn't a great advertisement as far as Tiffany was concerned, but the school did have a stellar reputation. It freaking well ought to have, for what it charged. And Vid had wanted to send Dakota from kindergarten. Tiffany thought that was ridiculous when there was a great little public school just down the road. Year five was the compromise. There was to be an information morning in August, 2 months away. It was compulsory for all students and both parents to attend. Compulsory. Tiffany felt her hackles rise at the email's officious tone and quickly closed it. She wasn't going to fit in at this place. She felt a real resistance to attending the information morning and even a certain level of nerves. As soon as she registered the feeling as fear, she was disgusted with herself. Furious, she snapped the laptop shut, refusing to even think about it. It was Sunday. They had the day free. She had a huge week ahead of her. Good book? She asked Dakota. What? Said Dakota. I mean, pardon? Tiffany said, I love you, Dakota. Long pause. What? The front door banged. There was a mark on the wall from where Vid threw it open each time he came into the house, as if he were making a grand return from an epic journey. Where are you, women? He shouted. Where you left us, you peanut, called back Tiffany. I am not a peanut. Why do you keep calling me that? It doesn't even make sense. Now, listen to me. I have news. He came in swinging his rolled-up paper like a baton. He looked energized. I just invited the neighbors over for a barbecue. Ran into Erika in the street. Vid. Tiffany rested her head on her hand. Why would you do that? Erika and Oliver were nice enough, but they were so freaking shy and serious. It was hard work. It was better to invite them over when other people were going to be there, so you could pass them on when you got tired of all the seriousness. You promised we'd have just one Sunday relaxing, she said. She had such a busy week ahead of her. A property going to auction on Tuesday night, a fight with a local council at the Land and Environment Court on Wednesday, and a painter, a tiler, and an electrician, well, Vid, were all waiting on her to make decisions. She needed a break.
What are you talking about? That's what we're doing. Relaxing on this beautiful day,
protested Vid, looking genuinely puzzled.
What's more relaxing than a barbecue? I'm going to call Drago, organize a pig. Oh, and their friends are coming. Remember the cellist, Clementine. Clementine and her husband. What was his name?
Sam, said Tiffany, perking up. She'd liked Sam. He had that short, broad-chested, blonde surfer boy look she used to go for before Vid, and he was funny and easygoing. They'd met them just the once when Erica and Oliver had hosted Christmas drinks at their place last year. That had been such a strange night. Vid and Tiffany had never been to a drinks party like it. All these people standing about, talking so quietly, as if they were in a library or church. One woman was drinking a cup of tea.
Where's the food? Vid kept whispering too loudly to Tiffany, while Oliver and Erica seemed to spend an inordinate amount of time worriedly wiping down already clean kitchen benchtops with dishcloths,
as if to make it clear their guests were making a mess, but they were on top of it. It had been such a relief when they got introduced to Clementine and Sam. Vid, who loved classical music, had been so excited to learn that Clementine was a cellist. It was almost embarrassing. But then Tiffany and Sam got talking politics and had an enjoyable argument. He was a bleeding heart, but she forgave him that.
Do you think we could order a pizza? Sam had whispered at one point, and Vid had roared laughing. Although then they all had to stop him from pulling out his mobile phone and actually ordering one.
Clementine found a chocolate bar in the bottom of her handbag and surreptitiously divided it up among the four of them, while poor Erica and Oliver were busy polishing their benchtops. It was like they'd all been marooned on a desert island and had done what they could to survive.
"They've got two little girls," said Vid.
"I remember they said they had little kids," said Tiffany. "Cutesy little names."
"I don't remember their names," said Vid. "Anyway, Dakota can play with them, you know. Can't you, Dakota?"
He looked hopefully at Dakota. Guys, there's someone at the front door," said Dakota, without looking up from her book, as Barney, eyes alert, lifted his head from her arm and leapt to the floor, where he ran around in circles, yapping delightedly. Barney liked guests nearly as much as Vid.
Someone was thumping over and over again on the front door, ignoring the doorbell.
"You didn't invite them right this very minute, did you?" said Tiffany.
"Shush, Barney!"
"Vid? Did you?" Vid was standing at the pantry, pulling out ingredients.
"Of course I did not," he said distractedly,
although he was perfectly capable of doing that. Tiffany went to answer the door, Barney zigzagging excitedly in front of her, almost tripping her up, and found Harry, the old man who lived next door, standing on the front porch, glowering at her, as usual, in his normal outfit of old grey suit trousers, from his old job maybe, and a white business shirt going yellow around the collar. White tufts of hair spurted from the top button of his shirt. He had white bushy eyebrows, just like Barney.
"Hello, Harry," said Tiffany, smiling as nice a smile as she could muster, while thinking, "And how have we freaking well offended you today, my elderly friend?"
"How are you?"
"This keeps happening," shouted Harry. "It's unacceptable."
He handed her a letter addressed to Vid.
"I've spoken to you about it before. I don't want your mail. I shouldn't have to deliver your mail. It's nothing to do with me."
"It's the postman, Harry," said Tiffany. "He accidentally put it in the wrong letterbox. It happens."
"It's happened before," said Harry belligerently.
"Yes, I think it did happen one other time," said Tiffany.
"Well, you need to put a stop to it. Are you stupid? It's not my responsibility."
"Okay, Harry," said Tiffany.
"Harry, mate."
Vid strolled out into the hallway, stuffing a handful of purple grapes into his mouth.
"You want to come to a barbecue later? We're having Erica and Oliver over. You know, from number 7.
Harry blinked at Vid. He put his hand inside his shirt front and scratched.
"What? No, I don't want to come to a barbecue."
"Ah, That's a pity, said Vid.
He put his arm around Tiffany.
Maybe another time. But, Harry, you know, I don't want to hear you calling my wife stupid. Okay, Harry? That's not nice. That's not neighborly.
Harry looked at them with his roomy brown eyes.
I don't want any more of your letters, he muttered. Not my responsibility. You've got to take responsibility.
We take a responsibility, said Vid. Don't you worry about that.
Get that dog away from me, said Harry,
as Barney sniffed his shoe with fascination. Barney lifted his bearded little face, as if his feelings were hurt.
Come on, Barney.
Vid clicked his fingers at the dog. You know, we're always here if you need us, Harry, said Tiffany. He suddenly seemed so heartbreaking, like a confused child.
What? Harry looked appalled. Why would I need you? Just keep your damned letters out of my letterbox.
He shuffled off, shoulders bowed, shaking his head and muttering. Vid shut the door. Harry was already forgotten.
Right, he said. Do I feel like baking? Yes, I feel like baking. Will I make strudel? What do you think? Strudel. Yes, I think most definitely strudel.
Chapter 10. Erica was back in the dry comfort of her office. The return cab fare from the library where Clementine had given her talk had been even more than the one out there. She'd just wasted 134 non-claimable dollars. She couldn't understand her own decision-making process. Listening to Clementine had certainly not filled in any gaps in her memory. All it had done was to stir up all sorts of uncomfortable feelings, and then she'd had to deal with the phone calls from both her husband and her mother on the way back in the taxi. She couldn't wait to throw herself into some complex work. It would clear her mind almost as well as going for a good hard run with multiple hill sprints. Thank goodness she didn't have a job like Clementine's, where you needed to constantly draw upon the well of your own emotions. Work should be devoid of emotion. That was the joy of work. She listened to her voicemail messages while she watched the rain falling outside the thick glass of her window. The weather had no relevance when you were safely ensconced in a high-rise office block. It was like it was happening in another dimension. As she scrolled through her email inbox, her phone rang, and she saw it was Oliver again. She'd spoken to him less than half an hour ago. Surely he wasn't ringing to ask her again about talking to Clementine. He must have a good reason to call.
Sorry to disturb you again, he said quickly. I'll be fast. I just wondered if you'd seen Harry around lately.
Harry? Said Erica as she opened an email. Who is Harry?
Harry, said Oliver impatiently. Our next door neighbour.
For heaven's sake, Harry was hardly a good friend. They barely knew the old man. And in point of fact, he wasn't their next door neighbour. He lived on the other side of Vid and Tiffany.
I don't know, said Erica. I don't think so. Why?
I was talking to Tiffany when I took out the bins, said Oliver. He stopped to blow his nose, and Erica stiffened at the mention of Tiffany, her hand on her computer mouse. She hadn't wanted anything to do with Tiffany and Vid since the barbecue. They'd never had a real friendship anyway. It was proximity. Tiffany and Vid liked Clementine and Sam much more than them. If Erica hadn't mentioned Clementine that day, if she'd said they had the day free, would Vid still have asked them over for a barbecue? Unlikely. Anyway, I mentioned to her that I hadn't seen Harry in a while, said Oliver. We decided to go over together and looked at his letterbox, and it was pretty full. So we took his mail up and knocked on his door, but there was no answer.
I tried to look in a window, but I don't know. I just have this feeling that something isn't right. Tiffany's calling Vid now to ask if he knows anything. Okay, said Erica. She had no interest in any of this. Maybe he's gone away. I don't think Harry goes on holiday, said Oliver. When was the last time you saw him?
I have no idea, said Erica. She was wasting time on this. Not for a while.
I'm wondering if I should call the police, fretted Oliver. I mean, I don't want to embarrass him if he's fine or waste police resources, but
he'll have a spare key, said Erica. There'll be one under a garden pot or something near the front door.
How do you know? Said Oliver.
I just know, said Erica. He's of that generation.
Erica's grandmother had always left a key under a pot of geraniums by the front door, whereas Erica's mother would never have risked the horror of someone coming into her home without her permission. Her front door was double deadlocked at all times to protect the oh-so-precious contents of her home.
Right, said Oliver. Good idea. I'll try that.
He hung up abruptly, and Erica put down the phone and found herself unwillingly and annoyingly distracted by the thought of her elderly neighbour. When was the last time she'd seen him? He would have been complaining to her about something. He didn't like anyone parking on the street outside his house, and he was always full of complaints about Vid and Tiffany. The noise, they liked to entertain, he'd called the police more than once, the dog, Harry said it dug up his garden. He'd put in an official complaint to the council. The general look of the place looks like the bloody Taj Mahal. He seemed to genuinely hate Tiffany and Vid, and even Dakota. But he tolerated Erica and seemed to quite like Oliver. She stood up and walked over to her office window. Some people, like her managing partner, couldn't stand too close to the windows in this building. The way the windows were set gave you the sensation of standing at the edge of a cliff. But Erica enjoyed the drop in her stomach as she looked out at the streets snarled with rainy day traffic below. Harry. The last time she remembered seeing him was the morning of the barbecue. It was when she rushed out to buy more crackers. She'd been worried about those sesame seeds. As she'd driven off down the street, she'd looked in her rear vision mirror and caught sight of Harry yelling at Vid and Tiffany's dog. He'd kicked out his foot aggressively. But Erica was sure he hadn't actually made contact with the little dog. He'd just done it for effect. Vid had come out onto his front veranda, presumably to call for the dog. That's all she'd seen. Erica didn't have a problem with Harry's grumpiness. Grumpiness was less time-consuming and tiring than cheeriness. Harry never wanted to stand around chatting for long. She wondered if something had happened to him, if he was sick perhaps, or if he was fine, and poor, responsible Oliver was going to get his head snapped off for interfering. A flash of lightning lit up the city skyline like a firework, and Erica imagined how she would look to someone on the street below if they happened to glance up at the rainy sky right at that moment and see her dark, solitary figure illuminated against the window. The image carried a memory. Perhaps it did. Maybe it did. Of hands pressed against glass. A face without features, except for the idea of a mouth, a gaping mouth. But then the memory split and fractured into a thousand tiny pieces. Was it possible she'd done something irreparable and catastrophic to her brain chemistry that day? She turned away from the window and hurried back to her desk to open a spreadsheet. Any spreadsheet, as long as it made sense, it added up. And as the soothing figures filled her computer screen, she picked up her phone and rang her psychologist's number and said to the secretary, lightly, as if it didn't really matter, "I don't suppose you have any cancellations for tomorrow?" But then she changed her mind and begged. Please? Chapter 11. Oliver put down the phone from Erica and blew his nose hard. He picked up his umbrella. It was not the best for his health to be traipsing about in the pouring rain checking on elderly neighbours, but there was no way he could delay it a moment longer. He had a terrible feeling about this. The last time he could remember seeing Harry was the day before the barbecue, before there was any plan of a barbecue, before Erica's curveball, when it was still just afternoon tea with Clementine and Sam and the girls, as per the plan. That Saturday afternoon, Harry had ambled over for a chat and given Oliver some tips about the correct way to hold the whippersnipper. Some people didn't like being given unsolicited advice, but Oliver was always happy to learn from other people's experiences. Harry had complained about Vid and Tiffany's dog. Its barking kept him up at night, apparently. Oliver had found that hard to believe. Barney was such a little dog. Harry had said he was calling the police, or it might have been the local council, but frankly, Oliver hadn't taken that much notice. Harry was always making official complaints through whatever official channels he could find. Making complaints was like a hobby for him. Everyone needed an interest when they retired. That was 2 months ago now. And Oliver couldn't remember seeing Harry since then. He opened his front door and jumped back when he saw Tiffany there, her umbrella tipped back on her shoulders as she stood on the shelter of their front veranda, her hand up as if she'd been just about to knock. "Sorry," she said, "I know you're sick, but it's just that I've been thinking about Harry. I really think we should try to break in or call the police. Vid can't remember seeing him for weeks either." "Neither can Erica," said Oliver. "I was just about to go over." He was suddenly frantic. It was as if every minute counted now. "Let's go." The wind picked up. "My God, this rain." They held their umbrellas up like riot shields and ducked behind them as they hurried over the lawns and back onto the front veranda of Harry's house. Tiffany dropped her umbrella in a soggy heap and began banging on the door with a closed fist.
"Harry!"
she called over the noise of the rain. There was a panicky note in her voice.
"Harry! It's just us! Just the neighbours!"
Oliver lifted up a heavy sandstone pot. No key underneath. There was a set of crappy old green plastic pots with very dead plants and dry crumbling soil. Surely Harry wouldn't keep a key under one of them. But he lifted the first pot, and there it was. A small gold key. "Harry, old mate," thought Oliver. "That's not great security." "Tiffany." Oliver held up the key to show her.
"Ah," said Tiffany.
She stood back as Oliver went to the front door and put the key in the lock.
"He might have gone away," she said tremulously, "to see family."
But they both knew he hadn't gone away.
"Harry?"
called out Oliver as he opened the door.
"Oh, God, no, no, no," said Tiffany immediately.
The smell took a fraction longer to get past Oliver's blocked nostrils, and then it was like he'd walked smack bang into a wall of it. A wall of smell. Sweet, rotten smell. It was like someone had sprinkled cheap perfume over meat that had gone off. His stomach heaved. He looked back at Tiffany and he was reminded of the day of the barbecue, how in times of crisis a person's face is somehow stripped back to something essential and universally human. All those labels like beautiful, sexy, plain, became irrelevant.
Fuck,
she said sadly. Oliver pushed the door all the way open and took a step forward into the dim light. He'd never been inside before. All his interactions with Harry had taken place in front yards. Harry's front yard. His front yard. A single light burned overhead. He could see a long hallway with a surprisingly beautiful red runner leading off into darkness. A staircase with a curved wooden banister. At the bottom of the staircase lay a large, unfamiliar object. And of course, he knew already it had to be Harry's body. That exactly what he'd feared had happened. But still, for a few seconds, he stared, trying to puzzle it out, as if it were one of those tricky optical illusion pictures. It just didn't seem possible that cranky, stomping, spitting Harry was now that bloated, blackened, silent thing of horror. Oliver registered certain things. Harry's socks weren't matching. One black, one grey. His glasses had sunk into his face as if they'd been pressed firmly by an unseen hand into soft, yielding flesh. His white hair was still as neatly combed as ever. A tiny swarm of busily buzzing flies. Oliver's stomach recoiled. He stepped back on trembling legs and pulled the door shut while Tiffany vomited into the sandstone pot, and the rain continued to fall and fall. Chapter 12. The Day of the Barbecue. Dakota sensed a flash of movement in her peripheral vision. She looked out the window and saw Barney streak across the lawn. The front door flew open with a bang, and she heard her dad shout,
"I've had just about enough of that man. Tiffany, where are you? He's crossed a line. There is a line, Tiffany, a line. And this time, that man has crossed it."
She heard her mother from somewhere else in the house call out,
"What?"
"Pardon?" thought Dakota.
"Dakota, where is your mother? Where are you?"
Dakota was exactly where she had been all morning, reading her book on the window seat. But of course, her dad didn't notice details like that. The house was so big, they could never find each other.
"You need a map to get around this place,"
Dakota's auntie said every single time she came over, even though she'd been here a million times and did not need a map at all. She even knew exactly where everything went in the kitchen cupboards, better than Dakota did. Dakota didn't answer her dad. Her mum had said she could finish the chapter before she had to help tidy up the house for the visitors. As if the visitors were her choice. She looked up, considering, because she'd actually sneaked just a little way into a new chapter, but she looked back down at the page, and just seeing the words were enough to pull her back in. She felt it like a pleasurable physical sensation, as if she were literally falling straight back into the world of the Hunger Games, where Dakota was Katniss and she was strong and powerful and skilled, but also very pretty. Dakota was 100% certain that she'd be like Katniss and sacrifice herself in the games for her cute little sister, if she had one. She didn't particularly want one. Her friend Aisling's little sister was always there, hanging about, and poor Aisling could never get rid of her. But if Dakota did have a little sister, she'd totally die for her. "Where are you, Dakota?" called out her mother this time.
"Here," whispered Dakota. She turned the page. "I'm right here."
Chapter 13. "Harry is dead," said Oliver, almost the moment Erica arrived home from work and put down her briefcase and umbrella. She touched her neck. Ice-cold raindrops were running down her back. Oliver was sitting on the couch, surrounded by a little lake of squashed, used-up tissues. "Seriously?" said Erica. She was focused on the tissues. "What happened?" The sight of the tissues made her heart rate pick up. Visceral response linked to childhood trauma, perfectly natural, 3 deep breaths. She just needed to get rid of those tissues. "Tiffany and I found his body," said Oliver, as Erica hurried to the cupboard under the kitchen sink to find a plastic bag. "Where?" said Erica, scooping up tissues. "At his house, do you mean?" She tied the handles of the plastic bag into a firm, satisfying knot and took it over to the bin and dropped it in. "Yes," said Oliver. "You were right about the key. It was under a pot."
"So he was dead?"
said Erica as she stood at the sink, scrubbing her hands. People always asked if she'd been in the medical profession because of the way she washed her hands. When she was in public, she tried to be less obviously rigorous. But now that she was home with Oliver, she could scrub and scrub without worrying that someone would diagnose her with OCD. Oliver never judged. "Yes, Erica," said Oliver. He sounded aggravated. He was very dead. He'd been dead for some time.
"Weeks and weeks, I'd say."
His voice broke.
"Oh, I see. Oh, dear."
Erica turned from the sink. Oliver looked very pale. His hands lay limply on his knees and he sat upright, his feet flat on the floor. Like a kid in the throes of terrible remorse, sitting outside the school principal's office. She took a breath. Her husband was upset. Extremely upset, by the look of it. So he probably wanted and needed to share. People with dysfunctional childhoods like hers didn't have the best interpersonal skills when it came to relationships. Well, it was just a fact. No one had modelled a healthy relationship for her. No one had modelled a healthy relationship for Oliver either. They had their dysfunctional childhoods in common. That's why Erica had invested close to $6,000 to date in high-quality therapy. The cycles of dysfunction and mental illness did not have to carry over from generation to generation. You just had to educate yourself. Erica went and sat on the couch next to Oliver and indicated by her body language that she was ready to listen. She made eye contact. She touched his forearm. She would use hand sanitizer once they finished talking. She really didn't want to catch that horrible cold.
"Was he..."
She didn't want to know the answers to any of the questions she knew she should ask.
Was he, what, in bed?
She thought of a maniacally grinning corpse sitting upright in a bed, one rotting hand on the coverlet.
He was at the bottom of the stairs. As soon as I opened the door, we could smell it. Oliver shuddered.
God, said Erica.
Smell was one of her issues. Oliver always laughed at the way she'd drop rubbish in the bin and then jump back so the smell couldn't catch her.
I only looked for 1 second and then I slammed the door shut and we called the police.
That's awful, said Erica mechanically.
Horrible for you.
She felt herself resist. She didn't want to hear about it. She didn't want him to share this experience with her. She wanted him to stop talking. She wanted to talk about dinner. She wanted to calm down after the day she'd had. She'd skipped lunch and she'd stayed back at work to make up for the time she'd wasted going to Clementine's talk, so she was starving. But obviously, after your husband tells you about finding a corpse, you can't then immediately follow it with, fancy some pasta? No. She'd have to wait at least half an hour before she could mention dinner.
The police said they think maybe he fell down the stairs, said Oliver. And I keep thinking,
he made strange little breathy noises. Erica tried to keep the irritation off her face. He was going to sneeze. Every sneeze was a performance. She waited. No, he wasn't going to sneeze. He was trying not to cry. Erica recoiled. She couldn't join him in this. If she allowed herself to feel sad and guilty about Harry, who she hadn't even liked, then who knew what could happen? It would be like uncorking a champagne bottle that had been vigorously shaken. Her emotions would fly all over the place. Messy. She needed order. I need order, she'd told her psychologist. Of course you need order, her psychologist had said. You crave order. That's perfectly understandable. Her psychologist was the nicest person she knew. Oliver took his glasses off and wiped his eyes.
I keep thinking, what if he fell down the stairs and he couldn't move and he was calling and calling for help, but nobody heard? We all just went about our daily lives while Harry starved to death. What if that happened? We're like those neighbours you see on TV and you think, how could you not have noticed? How could you not have cared? So what if he was a bit grumpy?
Well, you know, Vid and Tiffany are right next door to him, said Erica. She did not want to think about Harry lying on the floor. The sun rising and setting. Hearing the sounds of the neighbourhood. Lawnmowers, garbage trucks, the leaf blower he hated so much.
I know. Tiffany is really upset too. But you know what? I was the one on the street he probably liked the most. He tolerated me. Anyway, I mean, we had some civil conversations.
I know, said Erica. Like that time you were both so mad about that abandoned car outside the Richardsons.
I should have noticed he hadn't been out and about, said Oliver.
He took a tissue from the box and blew his nose noisily.
I did think I hadn't seen him for a while, maybe a week or so ago, but then I just forgot about it.
He wouldn't have starved to death, reflected Erica. It would have been the lack of water that killed him. Dehydration.
Erica!
Oliver winced. He dropped his scrunched-up tissue on the couch next to him and pulled another one from the box.
What? I'm just saying he didn't lie there for weeks on end.
She paused. He should have had one of those emergency alarm things around his neck.
Well, he didn't, said Oliver shortly. He blew his nose again.
And I guess he had no family, said Erica. No friends. Because he was such a nasty, vindictive old bastard. She wasn't going to let Oliver drag her into the morass of guilt into which he was sinking. Let Tiffany sink with him. Erica already lived with the permanent thrum of guilt.
I guess he didn't, said Oliver. Or, if he did, we never saw them visit. That's why it was up to us to keep an eye out for him. These are the people who slip through the cracks of society. I mean, as a community, we have a moral obligation to...
The landline rang, and Erica leapt to her feet as though she'd won a prize.
I'll get it.
She picked up the phone. Hello?
Erica, darling, it's Pam.
That well-bred, well-projected voice. The voice of good sense and good manners.
Pam, said Erica. Hi.
She felt an instant softening and a ticklish feeling of imminent tears. She felt it whenever she spoke to Clementine's mother. That old childhood adoration, the dizzy, glorious feeling of relief, as if she'd been rescued at sea.
I'm babysitting for Clementine and Sam, said Pam. They've just left. They're going out for dinner at that new restaurant in the overseas passenger terminal people have been raving about. I booked it for them. It's got 3 hats, maybe even 5 hats. I don't know. An impressive number of hats. Hopefully they're having as nice a time as can be expected, although I wish it wasn't raining. But fingers crossed. They need it, the poor kids. To be frank, I'm worried about their marriage.
That's talking out of school, I know, but, well, you're her best friend, so you probably know more than me about it.
Oh, well, I don't know about that, said Erica.
In actual fact, Erica knew nothing about Clementine's marriage problems. Surely Pam knew that the best friends label had been created by her, and for all those years, Erica had clung to it, while Clementine merely endured it.
Anyway, Erica, darling, I know we're seeing you soon for our special dinner at my place, which I'm really looking forward to. But listen, the reason I thought I'd give you a call tonight...
Erica heard the tentativeness in Pam's voice, and her jaw clenched.
Well, I had to go to Flower Power today, which meant I drove by your mum's house, said Pam. I didn't stop. She paused. Perhaps I should have. But your mum has really taken against me in recent years, hasn't she?
She didn't wait for an answer.
Erica, I know you stick to a schedule now with your visits, and I think that's a really sensible idea for your own mental health. But I'm thinking perhaps you need to bring this month's visit forward.
Erica breathed out a long, thin stream of air, like she was blowing up a balloon. She looked at Oliver. He'd closed his eyes and let his head tip back against the couch, one hand pressed to his forehead.
How bad? She said to Pam.
Pretty bad, darling, I'm afraid.
Pretty bad.
Chapter 14.
How did your, thing at the library go today? Your, what do you call it? Speech.
asked Sam in a strangled voice, as though the question were being forcibly squeezed from him.
It went well, began Clementine. Many people there?
Interrupted Sam. He piano played his fingertips on the white linen tablecloth and scanned the restaurant feverishly, as if there were someone or something he needed.
How many would you say? 20? 30?
Less than 20, said Clementine. One of them was Erica. She waited for a reaction, and when none seemed forthcoming, she said, I didn't really understand why she wanted to come.
Well, Erica is your biggest fan, said Sam with a faint smile.
That was kind of a joke. It gave her hope for the night that he was making a joke. Sam had been the first man she ever dated who immediately and instinctively grasped the complexities of her friendship with Erica. He'd never reacted with impatience or incomprehension. He'd never said, I don't get it. If you don't like her, don't hang out with her. He'd just accepted Erica as part of the Clementine package, as if she were a difficult sister.
That's true, said Clementine, and she laughed too loudly, although she left halfway through.
Sam said nothing. He looked just to the right of her head, as if there was something interesting going on behind her.
How was work today?
She said. Fine, said Sam coldly.
Same as usual?
Your marriage is being tested, darling, but the best comes after the worst. Forgiveness and communication is the only way through.
Clementine's mother had said all this in a dramatic, passionate whisper to Clementine, as if she were imparting urgent words of wisdom before Clementine set off on some epic journey. They were standing together at the front door waiting for Sam, who had chosen that moment to sit down at the computer and answer an email that was apparently a matter of life and death, while the jarring sound of some terrible pop princess movie blared out from the television. Pam had made a tiny, unnecessary adjustment to the strap of Clementine's dress.
The two of you need to talk. Talk it out. Say what you feel.
So, how's that forward-thinking corporate culture working out for you? Said Clementine.
Once, she could have said exactly those words and made him laugh, but now she could hear the thread of spite in her voice. Two musicians could play the same notes and sound entirely different. Intonation was everything. It's working out great for me. Sam looked at her with something like hatred. Clementine dropped her eyes. Sometimes when she looked at him, she felt like there was a sleeping snake tightly coiled within her chest, a snake that would one day hiss to life and strike with unimaginable, unforgivable consequences. She changed the subject.
I have to admit, I don't really enjoy doing these talks, she said.
Each time she felt so nervous, but it was an entirely different sort of anxiety from the kind she felt before a performance or even an audition. Her audiences always clapped, but it was subdued applause, and often she sensed an undertone of disapproval. She looked out the rain-dotted giant glass window, revealing a blurry postcard view of Sydney Harbour, complete with the white sails of the opera house, where she'd performed just two nights previously. I sort of hate it. She glanced back at Sam. An expression of intense aggravation crossed his face. He virtually shuddered with it.
Then stop, he said. Just stop it.
Why do you keep doing them? You're obsessed. You've got enough on your plate. You should be preparing for your audition. Are you even going to audition?
Of course I'm still going to audition, said Clementine. Why do people keep asking her that?
I've been getting up at 5 a.m. to practice every day.
How could he not know that? She knew he'd been having trouble sleeping. She'd wake up sometimes in the middle of the night and hear his footsteps in the hallway or the muted sound of the television from downstairs.
Haven't you heard me?
I guess maybe I have heard you, said Sam uncomfortably. I guess I didn't put two and two. I didn't realize you were practicing.
What did he think she was doing? Was the sound of the cello just irrelevant background noise to him? Or did he not care enough even to wonder?
She managed to keep the fractiousness she was feeling out of her voice. And I went to Ainsley's place today to practice, in front of her and Hugh.
Oh, said Sam.
He seemed genuinely taken aback.
Well, great, I guess.
How did it go?
Fine.
It went fine.
It hadn't gone fine. It had been strange and awful. Hugh and Ainsley had argued quite vehemently over her performance of the first movement of her concerto.
Wonderful, Hugh had said as soon as she finished. Bravo, give the girl a job.
He looked expectantly at his wife, but Ainsley wasn't smiling.
Well, she said uncomfortably, you've obviously been working really hard. It was technically perfect. It's just, I don't know, it didn't sound like you. If I was behind the screen, I would never have picked it was you.
So what? Said Hugh.
It was so accurate. Every single note, precisely where it should be. I would have guessed it was an arrogant 20-year-old whiz kid, straight out of the con.
And I say again, so what? If she played like that, she'd absolutely get through to the next round, said Hugh. I'd put her through for sure. You would too. I know you would.
Maybe, but I don't think it would get her through the second round. There was something almost, don't take this the wrong way, Clementine, but there was something almost robotic about it.
Hugh said, how can she not take that the wrong way?
We're here to be honest, said Ainsley. Not kind. Then she looked at Clementine and said suddenly, are you sure you still want it? After everything?
Of course she still wants it, said Hugh. What's wrong with you?
Then their house phone had rung, and Clementine never got to answer what should have been a straightforward question.
How are Ainsley and Hugh? Asked Sam.
She could see the strain it cost him just to ask an ordinary civil question. It was like watching him do a chin-up.
I haven't seen them for a while.
But he was trying, so she'd try too.
Good. They're good. Hey, I was telling Hugh how you got me to run on the spot before practicing my excerpts, and he said he had a teacher who made him do that.
Sam looked at her dully.
You would think it had been somebody else who'd pinned the bedsheet to the ceiling all those weeks ago, who had yelled, run, soldier, run!
She ploughed on. His teacher also used to tell him to wake up and practice in the middle of the night, when he was still half asleep, and to play after he'd had a few drinks. Speaking of which, oh, good, here comes somebody. A young waiter approached their table and stood just a little too far back.
Would you like me to go through today's specials?
He squared his shoulders in the heroic manner of someone volunteering to do something perilous.
Yes, but we're actually wondering about our drinks. We ordered 2 glasses of wine, a while ago.
1 million years ago.
Clementine tried to soften her words with a smile. The waiter was painfully young and sort of famished looking. He'd be perfectly cast as a street urchin in Les Miserables.
You haven't got your drinks yet?
The waiter looked alarmed, as if he'd never heard of such a thing. Clementine gestured at their table to indicate.
No drinks, just their 2 mobile phones placed at precise angles in front of them, ready to be snatched up in case of crisis. Because that's how they lived now, in readiness for crisis.
Maybe they've been forgotten, suggested Clementine.
Maybe, said the waiter.
He glanced fearfully over his shoulder at the restaurant bar, where a pretty waitress dreamily polished wine glasses.
You could check on them, said Clementine.
For the love of God, why was this swanky restaurant employing children? Starving children? Feed him and send him home.
Of course, right, it was 2 glasses of the
pepper tree Shiraz, said Clementine. She could hear a fishwifey, high-pitched note in her voice.
Right, shall I just go through the specials first?
No, said Clementine at the same time as Sam said, sure, mate. He smiled up at the waiter.
Let's hear the specials. He always snatched the good cop role for himself.
The waiter took a deep breath, clasped his hands, choir boy style, and recited,
"For an entree, we have a confit of salmon cooked in coriander, orange, and mint."
He stopped. His lips moved silently.
Clementine pressed her fingertip against her phone. It lit up. No calls. Everything was fine. Sam shifted in his chair and gave the waiter a tiny, "You can do it," nod of encouragement, as though he were an affectionate parent in the audience at a poetry recital. Watching her husband, the exasperating humanity of the man, Clementine felt an unexpected jolt of love, like one perfect, pure note, a velvety E-flat. But as soon as she registered the feeling, it was gone, and she felt nothing but itchy irritability as the waiter haltingly made his way through the longest list of specials in the history of fine dining.
A prosciutto and pepperoni. No, wait, not pepperoni. A prosciutto.
He rocked forward and studied his shoes, lips compressed. Clementine met Sam's gaze. Once, Clementine would only have needed to fractionally widen her eyes to make Sam lose his composure, and in his desperation not to hurt the waiter's feelings, his face would have turned red while his eyes filled with tears of mirth. But now, they just looked steadily at each other, and then away again, as if levity were against the new rules for life, where they trod so very carefully, where they checked and double-checked, where they knew better than to relax, even for a moment. The waiter continued on his torturous way, and Clementine distracted herself by playing the Brahms excerpt in her head while using her forearm as a pretend fingerboard under the tablecloth. The Brahms had lots of mini-phrases linked in one extended line. It needed to have that beautiful lyrical feel. Was Ainsley right? Was she focusing too much on technical perfection?
If you concentrate on the music, the technical problems often solve themselves,
Marianne used to tell her. But Clementine had come to believe she'd taken that advice too much to heart in every aspect of her life. She needed to be focused, to be disciplined, to clean up as she went, to pay her bills on time and follow the rules and grow the fuck up.
With a beef and goat's cheese parfait!
The waiter finished his recital in the jubilant rush of a carol singer chorusing, and a partridge in a pear tree. All sounds delicious, said Sam.
Do you want me to go back over anything?
Said the waiter. Absolutely not, said Sam, and Clementine nearly laughed out loud. He'd always been good at delivering a dry, straight-faced line.
Right, so you have a think, and in the meantime, I'll just check on your...
The waiter looked at Clementine. Shiraz, supplied Clementine. Pepper tree Shiraz?
Too easy.
The waiter snapped his fingers, jaunty with relief now that he'd got through the specials.
So,
said Sam after the waiter had gone.
So,
said Clementine.
What are you having?
Sam lifted the menu in front of him like a newspaper.
Not sure, said Clementine, picking up her own menu.
It all looks good. She needed to make a joke. A joke about the waiter, the specials, the non-arrival of the drinks. The girl behind the bar still obliviously polishing glasses. There was so much potential material. For a moment, it felt as though everything rested on this. If she could just make the right joke right now, she would save the night, save their marriage. Something about the girl taking a Buddhist approach to her job, mindfully polishing her wine glasses. If only she'd mindfully pour their drinks. Dear God, when did she become the sort of person who mentally rehearsed flippant remarks? Someone laughed in the restaurant. A man's laugh. A deep, distinctive, baritone laugh. Clementine's heart lurched. Sam's head jerked up from the menu. Not Vid. Not here. Not tonight. Chapter 15. There it was again, inappropriately loud for this soft carpeted place. Clementine swung her head to watch three men making their way through the restaurant. They all bore a superficial resemblance to Vid. The big bullet heads, giant shoulders, proud stomachs, and that European way of walking. Not quite a swagger. But none of them was Vid. Clementine exhaled. The man laughed again, but it didn't have the particular tone or depth of Vid's laugh at all. She turned back to Sam. He had closed his menu and let it fall back against his chest.
I thought it was Vid, he said. It sounded exactly like him.
I know, said Clementine. I thought it was him too.
Jesus. I just didn't want to see him.
He took the menu and placed it back on the table. He pressed his hand to his collarbone.
I thought I was going to have a heart attack.
I know, said Clementine again. Me too. Sam leaned forward, his elbows on the table.
It just brought it all back.
He sounded close to tears.
Just seeing his face would...
The Margaret River Shiraz.
Their young waiter triumphantly presented the bottle like a prize. It was the wrong wine, but Clementine couldn't bear to see his face crumple.
That's it, she said,
in a well-done-you tone. The waiter poured them overly generous glasses of wine, one hand behind his back. Red droplets stained the crisp white tablecloth. It might have been safer for him to use two hands.
"Are you ready to order?"
The waiter beamed at them, flushed with success. "Just a few more minutes," said Clementine.
"Oh, of course. Too easy."
The waiter backed away. Sam lifted his glass. His hand shook. "I thought I saw Vid in the audience at the symphony the other night," said Clementine. "It gave me such a shock, I forgot to come in. It's lucky Ainsley was my stand partner." Sam gulped a large mouthful of wine. He wiped the back of his hand across his lips.
"So you didn't want to see him?"
he said roughly.
"Well, of course I didn't want to see him. It would have been..."
Clementine couldn't come up with the right word. She lifted her own glass. There was no tremor in her hand. She'd learned to control a shaking bow arm without beta blockers, even while her heart thumped with excruciating stage fright. Sam grunted. He reopened his menu, but she could tell he wasn't reading it. He was busy reassembling himself, smoothing out his face, becoming bland again. She couldn't bear it. She wanted him to crack again. Although, actually, Erica mentioned the other day that Vid is keen to see us, said Clementine. She didn't want yet another generic conversation about the view and the menu and the weather. A conversation like elevator music. Sam glanced up at her, but his face was blank. His eyes were closed windows. She waited. There was that strange little pause before he answered. It was like a mechanical glitch. Nobody but her seemed to have noticed that Sam's timing was off when he spoke these days. "Well, I'm sure we probably will run into him sometime," he said. His eyes returned to the menu. "I think I'll have the chicken risotto." She couldn't bear it. "Actually, desperate was the word Erica used," she said. His mouth twisted. "Yeah, well, he's probably desperate to see you." "I mean, it's inevitable that we'll run into them again, isn't it?"
"I don't see why," said Sam.
"When we're visiting Erica and Oliver, we can't avoid driving down their street again." Although perhaps that's exactly what Sam intended. Maybe it was what she intended too. They could still see Erica and Oliver without going anywhere near their house. It would just be a matter of making the right excuse, deftly sidestepping Erica's invitations. They were never that keen on them in the first place. She remembered the first time she'd seen Erica and Oliver's new house. "We're kind of dwarfed by our neighbours," Erica had said, with a doubtful grimace at the castle-like mansion with its tizzy curls and curlicues. It looked especially over the top compared to Erica and Oliver's benign, beige bungalow, a safe, personality-less house that was so very them. Oh, but they couldn't laugh at Erica and Oliver like that anymore, could they? Their relationship had changed forever that day. The power balance had shifted. Clementine and Sam could never again make their superior, "We're so easygoing, they're so uptight," digs. Sam placed his menu carefully on the edge of the table. He readjusted the placement of his mobile phone. "Let's talk about something more pleasant," he said, with the social smile of a stranger.
"I mean, it wasn't their fault," she said.
Her voice was thick with inappropriate emotion. She saw him flinch. His colour rose.
"Let's talk about something else," repeated Sam. "What are you having?"
"I'm not actually that hungry," said Clementine.
"Good," said Sam. "Neither am I." He looked businesslike. "Shall we just go?"
Clementine put her menu on top of his and squared up the corners.
"Fine."
She lifted her glass. "So much for date night."
"So much for date night," agreed Sam contemptuously.
Clementine watched him swirl his wine in his glass. Did he hate her? Did he actually hate her? She looked away from him to their expensive, rainy view. She let her eye follow the choppy water to the horizon. You couldn't hear the rain from in here. Lights sparkled and winked on the skyscrapers. Romantic. If she'd just made the right joke. If that damned man hadn't laughed like Vid.
"Do you ever think,"
she said carefully, without looking at Sam, her eyes on a keeling solitary yacht, the wind tugging angrily at its sail. Who would choose to sail in this weather?
"What if we just hadn't gone? What if one of the girls had got sick? Or I'd had to work, or you'd had to work, or whatever. What if we just hadn't gone to the barbecue? Do you ever think about that?"
She kept her eyes on the maniac in the yacht. The too long pause. She wanted him to say, "Of course I think about it. I think about it every day." "But we did go," said Sam. His voice was heavy and cold. He wasn't going to consider any other possibilities for their life than the one they were leading. "We went, didn't we?" Chapter 16. The Day of the Barbecue. Erica checked the time. Clementine and Sam were expected 10 minutes ago, but that was normal for them.